thank you for the introduction, and thank you, Mark, for inviting me to come down here. I got lucky or unlucky in that I was able to make my plane. I was sitting in Baltimore, Washington Airport for quite a while yesterday in a nice long line, but I happened to make it down here. I'm also, after I finish my remarks, I will try to summarize and go through some of Dr. Taylor's slides with you, because I think he makes some interesting points that I don't make, and I think you need to see those. That's kind of strange for me, because usually I'm on the public advocate side of a case, and he's on the ILEC side of the case, and so it's not quite fair for me to be presenting his information, but I will try to do it as politely and nicely as I can, and make his points, and hopefully he'll be proud of what I say for him. Be that as it may. I want to start by setting a stage for the discussion that's not on the slides. And the stage that I want to set, as you see the title, Mark, you go back to 1907? I want to go back to, I guess that's when the Florida Commission got started. No? It's when the Wisconsin Commission got started. I want to go back a little earlier than that, just for a very short introduction, and that's to the stage of railroads in the 1880s and 1890s. And what did we see there with those railroads? They had trunk lines between major cities where there were four or five railroads competing very hard, and they would get into price wars a lot. And then they had spur lines, okay, where only there were farmers and small merchants, and they had real high prices there in order to help the price wars. And what happened every once in a while was the price wars got so intense that you had a lot of bankruptcies. And then you come out of those bankruptcies and they'd form nice little cartels. The cartel would last a couple of months, and then the price war would break out again. So what did your friend J.P. Morgan and the people at Wall Street, and you heard some people from Wall Street yesterday, they didn't like this, because when they sold bonds, it was hard to sell bonds when the companies were going bankrupt all the time because of price wars. So Wall Street didn't like the competition. The farmers who were out on the spur lines, they didn't like the way it was working. So between the two of them, we got independent commission regulation, the Interstate Commerce Commission. It was not because of universal service. It was not because of a natural monopoly. It was because of this word that we don't like to talk about too much anymore as economists, destructive competition among people with these huge networks with a lot of fixed cost, very little marginal cost, and if they get into price wars, they can really hurt each other. And they did, they went bankrupt a lot, and so we got regulation out of it, the independent commissions. Okay. How does that fit? Let's fast forward to our current, that's the end of the history lesson. Okay? What's going on now? Well, we have a lot of people talking about duopoly. Duopoly can spin, that's two companies dominating a market, can spin two different directions. They can get into a fierce price war. We saw that with Lucent and Nortel over the selling of circuit switches nearing the end of the circuit switch life. They killed each other off. They really hurt each other, selling those circuit switches, giving cheap loans to CLEX. Their profits were destroyed. They got into this fight. That is an option that, as you heard yesterday from Mr. Atkinson, Wall Street's scared of. They don't want the cable industry and the telephone industry getting into that kind of price war. What they want is a nice, quiet, joint monopoly profit. People live nice with each other. And what will happen when that occurs? Well, you go to one meeting, say it's the Chamber of Commerce, and the guy will get up and say, well, the triple play should go for about $110. And that will be the telephone speaker, and the cable guy will be in the seats. And then you go to the Kiwanis Club next week, and the cable guy will get up and say, well, the triple play should go for about $110. But we're fiercely competing with the telephone company over this. Nobody in either industry wants to see that price drop to $60. And it could easily if they got into a price war for the triple play. So the real thing to do is to prevent that triple play price war, because you can hurt both industries immediately, and they would have very tough times. So the question that we have going forward, how does deregulation impact that setting that we have now? That's the setting that there is. There could be a price war. A lot of people could get, a lot of investors could be hurt by the price war. Consumers might or might not benefit, because if the price war destroys investment, then you're not going to have a lot of the services that you want. So the question is, how does deregulation fit in? Simultaneously, you've got sitting on the sidelines, not that far off the sidelines, this is amazing growth in the wireless industry. I mean, the number of wireless subscribers has just grown leaps and bounds. Most people think that it can't grow any further. Well, it can grow some more. I mean, pretty soon people will be adding wireless phones to the list of things that you can give at baby showers, or you could, I think AARP is coming out with a new phone that says, you know, it only has three big buttons on it. One button is call your daughter, the next button is call the AAA to come get your car, and the third button is call 911, and the person, you know, I think I can get one out of three, okay? So hopefully I'm not insulting any seniors. I'm getting close enough to that age group now. I'm no longer, where I was starting. But you do have the wireless industry out there as, you know, very close. And the question is, how are they going to affect the duopoly? And what's really important about the wireless industry, not only are they close and affecting the duopoly, but the people who own the biggest wireless companies are also the people who own the biggest ILECs. And they, AT&T and Verizon, have always had this kind of internal conflict. Which business do they push? Which place do they put the investment? Where does it go? So simultaneously, they're competing with themselves, and they have to try to understand how are they going to move their industry forward with this internal competition happening within their own boardrooms and within their own presidential decisions and their own executive committees. So that's the background for what's happening in deregulation. So let's go look at some of the things that are happening. And here's the California situation. The California one's very important because California is a large commission. A lot of people look to California. It's a huge market. So what happens there, first off, whenever there's a case in California, because the California market is so big, all the players participate. And therefore, what happens in California is important to the rest of us. If the same case occurred in Delaware or Rhode Island, people wouldn't care that much. So that makes it very important. And they've just decided recently to do a major deregulation of telephone. Well, maybe you should think about how they led many people to the major deregulation of electricity before you jump on the bandwagon behind their telephone deregulation. But they did. And the most important reason for this that they noticed throughout the order was the assertion that wireless is now providing a good substitute for ILEC telephone services. That's the theme of the order. So if you want to go that route, you have to understand that's what's backing. So that's a major theme. They no longer think that, you know, mobile is a complement. They think of it as a substitute. My only come back to that, if it's really a substitute to most people, then why do we still have so many ILEC lines? I mean, they claim that ILEC lines are going down, and ILEC lines are going down. But there's still 140 million of them, and if there's over 200 million or something like that wireless lines, if it's a real substitute to most people, shouldn't they have gone down even faster? I still don't think, and this is, you know, my opinion, is that they are a substitute for some people for some things. For most people, they're still a complement. In other words, you use them together. They extend your ability to communicate. That's what a wireless does. You can communicate now in a whole bunch of different ways. It's a very convenient and very good tool of communications, but it extends and it doesn't substitute for most people. For some people it is a substitute, and thus you've got to make a decision, which do you think it is? The commission also refused to look at HHI, the Herkendahl-Hirschman Index, or Herkendahl Index, whichever you think is the more important person, and said that, you know, that's sort of like a snapshot. It's backward. The industry is dynamic. It's changing. We shouldn't look at this index anymore. It's not an important clue. It's not an important indicator of what's going to happen in the world. Well, industries are always changing. Industries are always dynamic. And you have the right to look at this as an indicator. And you have a right to project it 1 or 2 years out into the future, to think about whether or not you think it's important and what's going to happen in the next couple of years. But they said, no, the industry is dynamic, we don't want to look at it. We don't want to pay any attention to it. They also claimed that VoIP is an available substitute. And I'll get a little further into that in one of my next slides. The next thing they said was that ILECs don't have any market power because the UNIL, the unbundled network loop, is still out there. And I have a hard time thinking about that in terms of residential customers. The UNIL is used a lot still in small business and medium-sized markets. But we had two very large CLECs, MCI and the long-distance AT&T company, both give up the ghost, and the major reason in their public interest statement to the FCC was that they couldn't get UniP anymore, and because they couldn't get UniP, the Uni platform, they could no longer compete in the mass market. So if this is what they said, and this is the reason why the FCC approved the mergers, because there wasn't going to be any reduction in competition because of the mergers, now how can we turn around and say the UniL is going to allow competition in the residential market? Like I say, it's still there for the business market, the small business market, but I don't think it's there too much for the residential market. So what did they do? The first thing they did was eliminate their standard price cap regulation that they had. So that went. Everything that was in price cap regulations in California is now gone. The second thing is that they did was they said that basic residential service, they kept frozen, right? Well, I like this idea. Every regulator who deregulates keeps it frozen for 2 years or 5 years. The electric regulators are much smarter. They keep things regulated for 5 years so they can get quit, leave, and be out of town before the rates go up. The telephone regulators, they're not quite as smart. They only freeze for 2 years, so they're probably going to still be around when the rates go up. So there's a significant difference there. And then everything else, all other prices, you can do whatever you want. Okay, there's no regulation of any other price, except for special access. Now, I found that a little troubling, because special access, I don't know, did Mr. Atkinson work for Teleport? And wasn't, you know, Metropolitan Fiber Services supposed to be here and provide us competition? And wasn't special access the first part of the local markets that people thought was competitive? So if you believe that there's competition in the telephone markets, why do you hold on to special access? That should be the first thing that you let go, along with pay phones. It was the first thing that was let go by many state commissions, you know, when I was still a state regulator in the early 90s. Why does California still hold it? Well, I think the big buyers read the FCC staff paper that came out maybe 1 or 2 years ago, which said that in special access, they looked at the areas where the FCC allowed pricing flexibility and the areas where the FCC said you still had to use price caps. And they found that the rates where there was pricing flexibility went up faster than the rates in the price cap areas. And usually when you can increase price, that's a good indication that there's no competition, or not maybe none, but not sufficient enough, that the competition is not effective. So you have the big buyers realizing that we've been going down a road that hasn't been exactly the bed of roses that people have promised us. And maybe that's the reason why the California Commission didn't deregulate special access. Then you have the Texas law. This is by legislature. This has nothing to do with the commission. The commission can't do anything under the Texas law. What happened, okay, was that, again, you have this two-year freeze. The law was passed in 2005. September 1, 2007, everything is deregged. Okay? Between 2005 and today, things that were deregged was, well, say you sold a package that had call waiting and local service in it. You couldn't just raise the price of local service independently, but if it had a package and you were selling call waiting with it, then you could raise it. You had pricing freedom. And the last couple of years, the price of those kinds of packages have risen $2 and $3 a month. Okay? After September 1, 2007, then I tell you what's going to happen then. Well, you have the large populated areas. Okay? The law by itself said it was deregulated. Nothing the State Commission can do. In the medium-sized areas, you have the law sets a standard, which I believe is one alternative provider. So if the cable company provides telephone service, that area is deregulated. And then if you have the small markets, the rural areas of Texas, the commission sets the rule. I believe the commission rule is that you have to have three alternative providers before you deregulate. Okay? So that's the way it works in Texas, and the end result in Texas is that 74% of the population, the residential lines, will be deregulated come September. I mean, they're deregulated officially now, but they still have a price freeze until September. And then we have the New York State white paper, staff white paper. It said pricing flexibility for all the bundles. Anything that's connected, you know, you sell with call waiting, you sell with long distance, you sell with video, that is all they want to deregulate. Their standard was, they did a hypothetical experiment. They said, let's look at a $50 package that a telephone company is offering, and if they increase that $50 package by a given amount of money, what would happen to the telephone company? Say they went from $50 to $55. What would happen? Well, they did a simulation with elasticities, in other words, trying to figure out elasticity is just how will people respond to a change in price. They did that simulation, looked at how people in the $50 range would respond in price, and the answer was the telephone company would lose money if it tried to go from $50 to $55, and therefore they felt that there's enough competition in the bundles market to deregulate them. So they're separating the residential market into two markets here. I think that's important for anybody in the telephone industry, that you have to separate the residential market into the two markets, those for the bundles and those for the a la carte. And it's a significant difference between the markets. The next thing that they said was, well, they thought that, you know, we can hold this $25 maximum price. That any a la carte, in other words, if you just buy basic telephone service by itself, any company in the state of New York can increase that price to $24.95. That was the price that Verizon charges in New York City in Manhattan. Now, it's a relatively new price because up until very recently, Manhattan, you had to pay on a per-call basis. So it was measured service. So Verizon's put together this $24.95. But that's only in Manhattan. Most of Verizon's rates are between $18 and $22 in New York. So this means that they're going to go anywhere from a $3 to a $7 increase they're allowing for basic service. And then if you're in Frontier territory in Rochester, the other major company in New York, their rates are around $12. So this means you're going to get a doubling of the rates over a three-year period in Rochester. But they felt that, you know, gosh, that's just and reasonable, whatever you mean by that. Oops, I went too far. The next thing is in Pennsylvania, and this was also done by state law. Okay, Chapter 30 is the state law in Pennsylvania. And it's got three major principles that I lay out for you here. Non-protective is usually mostly your bundles. Protected is mostly your access charges and your basic residential and basic business service. If you buy it on an a la carte basis, that's a protected service. Just about everything else is non-protected services. They have a price cap, and it's related to the build-out. And the build-out, the broadband build-out, is essentially the high end of the DSL. It's 1.54. Well, that's not really even the high end anymore of DSL. That's sort of the middle range of DSL. So the broadband build-out is 1.54 megabits. And if you promise to build out faster, your productivity offset is lower. For example, for the rural companies, if they promised to have a build-out finished by 2008, they got a zero productivity offset. And if they promised by 2015, they got like a 0.2% or a very small productivity offset, but it was certainly reduced their ability to raise rates. So there's a relationship between the faster you build out and the more, the smaller the productivity offset. So that's in the law. And Verizon has a similar one, but it's slightly different in its approach. What I want to show you is what happened, though, in the price cap part of the regulation. You would take the sum of your protected services, and the two major protected services is access revenue and basic service revenue. Okay, so I got $350 million. I multiply it by 3%, let's say that's what your price cap index allows you to do. That would be inflation minus whatever the productivity offset is for your company. Okay? And you got an increase of 10.5%, 10.5 million. Who pays it? Well, access rates, as we know, are untouchable. You can't raise those. So you have this $10.5 million increase that is all assigned to basic services. So you don't get a 3% increase in basic services. You get 10.5 divided by 200, or a 5.25% increase in basic services. So while the law looks like it's pretty good, you know, it's going to be inflation minus some productivity offset, and people think, okay, 2 or 3% increase in basic services, because access rates contribute to the revenues, but don't get assigned any rate increase. All the rate increase falls on basic services. Basic services have gone up much faster than inflation. And that's the story there. Does that remind you of a Florida decision in rebalancing, where access rates went down and only a la carte services went up? None of the bundled customers had to pay for that rebalancing, if I remember correctly. I don't know, you guys are closer to that. Is that, that's what I think happened. Maybe, you know. Anyhow, maybe I'm too close to home. The A4s are a general term for alternative forms of regulation. And many of them are solved with settlements rather than going through the full rate case. The A4s in general include some kind of freeze for basic services. And I give you here three of them that occurred. And the next part of the A4, though, has been some kind of broadband incentive that the companies agreed to. And this is why they've come as settlements, because, as you know, the FCC, for the most part, has preempted state regulation from doing anything in the broadband area. You know, first they said that DSL was interstate, then they said DSL was information service, but no matter what they called it, it's not a state service. So for a state regulator to do something about the broadband build-out, or do anything in broadband, must be A, either do it from a universal service point of view, in other words, come through its state universal service fund, or go through a settlement in which you give up something and the company voluntarily, in order to make the settlement, gives you something. And what these have done in the top three is essentially what many states have seen, is that in the rural areas of their large Arbok, DSL is not being deployed anywhere near as rapidly as it's being deployed in other areas of the state. In other words, if you look at your rural carriers, you get DSL rollouts of 80 and 90%, if not higher. You get urban part of the Bell operating company, you get DS rollouts 80 and 90%. You look in the rural areas of the Arbok, and it's all stamped proprietary, so I can't tell you what it is, but I think everybody in the room knows it's much lower. So what these have done, what these settlements do, is try to get the Arbok, the former Bell operating company, to provide DSL services in the rural areas of the state. And that, if you think that that's worthwhile, that's something that has to do with remaining regulation. Then the next step is, well, if we're going to deregulate, do we have any standard by saying whether or not we have competition? And as you saw, California didn't like to use the HHI. Said it wasn't a good thing to look at. It's a dynamic market. We should look at this index. But anyhow, it's there. It's still in the horizontal merger guidelines of the Justice Department and the FTC. And what they say is that it's a good if it goes above 1,800, you need to start being worried. It doesn't say that it's definitely you got market power. It doesn't say that you definitely are going to have a lack of effective competition if it's above that. It just says, if it's over that mark, we better investigate and find out what's going on. If it's below that mark, you're safe. That's all it is. The next thing they do is they try to go through this experiment to see whether or not a firm could actually exercise market power, and that means it's got to be able to raise its price. And the general amount for the raise of the price is 5%. If you can sustain a 5% increase and competitors can't discipline that increase, then you have been able to exert market power. That, in the shorthand, is what those guidelines say. So then in my next slide, I just show you how to calculate. Well, it's the sum of the square of the company's market share. So here we've got five companies up there. You've got effective competition. All you need is five. It's nowhere like the textbook perfect competition. If you've got five companies, equal share companies, each one with 20% of the market, you square them, you sum them, you get 2,000. Hey, that's effective competition. Good example, the U.S. automobile industry. Okay? It's nowhere near what anybody would ever teach in an economics class as perfect competition, but it's effectively competitive because you've got five or six relatively equal firms, some of them like the U.S.-owned ones dying off, some of them like the foreign-owned ones making out, doing a good job, more profitable, but you still have a balance. And you have more than two or three, and you've got a balance among the players. That's what's meant by effective competition. You have a dominant firm, okay, and I rely more on Jeff Shepard for this. This is essentially what the dominant firm. You have one player and no close rivals. And then the next row down is what's typically found in residential telephone markets. So you get a Herfindahl index of 6,500, significantly above anything that anybody in the Justice Department would say is close to competition, which means you need to look at it. You need to be curious. So then I went and looked at the data reported by the FCC for Florida. I said, what do we have there? And you have to do a little arithmetic because it's not spelled out. But they tell you how many total lines you have, how many are ILEC lines, how many are CLEC lines, and then they tell you for the ILEC and for the CLEC what percent of the ILEC lines are residential and what percent of the CLEC lines are residential. So you just have to do a little multiplication and divide it up, and you get this, which shows that residential lines, ILEC, still have 94% of them. Now, it doesn't mean they're going to keep 94% of them. It just means that they've got them now. Now, some people complain, well, you know, you've left out two important players here. Because what's not in the FCC, this immediate, is, well, how many people are gone completely wireless, and how many people are going to VoIP through, okay, independent VoIP. And this is, you have to be very important, because people confuse this a lot. There's two ways to provide voice over internet protocol. One is through the public internet, the way companies like Vonage do, and they are the complete independent group. The other is the way the cable does, and the way Verizon has an offering now, and a couple of other ILECs have, but it's through their private network. And there's a significant quality of service differential between these two that you have to watch. Plus, okay, and first let you know, just review the numbers, and I'll get back to my plus in a second, is that, okay, the ILECs, I gave what the independent VoIPs have. They have about 2% of the market, Vonage and all the others. And then I put in the wireless people who have completely cut the cord, and 9% is a fairly high number for completely cutting the cord. In other words, not having any wireline service in your house. That's about where it is today. So you still have the ILECs having 83% of the residential market, even after I take into consideration the other two. That's still a fairly dominant position. Now, the next thing that happens is I want to talk a little bit more about Vonage and its position, and that is they're like, they have to rely on the kindness of strangers. And the stranger is the FCC. Because to get to Vonage, you have to buy a broadband service. And how much do you pay for that broadband service is very important. Okay? You have to pay, if you're just buying from Comcast, something like over $50 to get to Vonage. If you're buying from Quest, which hasn't had a merger lately, you have to pay $40 to get to Vonage. So 40 plus Vonage's advertised $25 rate is $65. $65 rate isn't going to give you much as far as a market share. You're not going to win too many customers at $65 when the same service, a more reliable service, is being sold by both Quest, the ILECs, and the cable company. So you're, you know, why do I say now you have to be dependent upon the kindness of strangers? Well, where AT&T is and where Verizon is, we've had mergers. And part of the merger conditions have always been that they have to offer standalone DSL at a reasonable rate. So in AT&T land and in Verizon land, you can get standalone DSL for something like $20. So $20 plus $25, hey, that's $45, $50 range. If you can sell something in the $45 and $50 range, you can compete with the telephone company's bundles. So, but these merger conditions only last for 3 years and then they sunset. So if you're Vonage, you've got to pray that AT&T buys Verizon so that you have another 3-year extension on your merger condition. Without that, I think Vonage is hurting. But that's my opinion. Next thing I want to do is go through how to count, because I think it's very important. We all think we know how to count. First grade, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know. You learned how to count. Well, I pulled this one up, 7 cell phones in a group house, because that's my daughter. Right? Everybody gets a little personal in these things. Right? Now, she lives in Brooklyn, right? Just graduated college. 6 of her closest buddies that all just graduated college. They have no wireline phone in the house. There's seven phones that each one has. None of them have ever paid a phone bill in their lives. And we take that as what's going to be the future. It might. I can't deny that it might. Mm-hmm. But has the ILEC lost seven lines? I don't think so. Let's go to the next example. Say they only bought one line from the cable. Well, like when I was a graduate student, we'd buy one line from the telephone company, had a group house, or we used pay phones. But let's say they don't, instead of the seven cell phones, they buy one from the cable company. Okay? There's a lot of boys in the house and they have to watch sports. Okay, so you go and get the triple play from the cable company and the ILEC has lost one line, so it's lost 1% of its market. Alternatively, you go to the third combination with one cable line and seven wireless lines, and the ILEC's now lost 8% of its market. Well, that's how you have to watch how people count. Because I don't think they would have lost 7% of their market here, or 8%. They only had the possibility in the past to sell one line, so they only lost 1% of their market, no matter which one of these scenarios happens. Yet people come up and tell you they've lost 8% of their market. I don't think so. Let's go to the next one. This compares, this is FCC ARMUS data. These are the three major telephone companies in Florida. Verizon, AT&T, no longer Bell South, and Embark, no longer Sprint. Okay. And it shows a comparison of the multi-line business lines that they sell, which are flat, and actually came up a little bit in the last year. 205 was a little bit better than 204, the multi-line business lines, and compared to their special access lines. And this is measured, I know, in voice grade equivalents, so that it's not circuits. Anybody can, you know, knows that problem and how to play the game between the two. You know, a DS1 is 24 voice grade, a DS3 is 672 voice grade equivalents. But this is the thing that's in the public domain, so I have to put it up. I can't get proprietary information in front of you. And it shows an explosion in special access services. So, yeah, you are losing the business market if you look at it in terms of the business market is stagnant if you look at it in terms of switched access. But the ILECs are selling special access as fast as the wireless subscribers are increasing and as fast as cable is selling anything else. So it's a huge growth market, and they're doing a hefty business there. So you got to watch what you're counting. Okay. Now this gets me back to my duopoly situation. This is the sort of a history of mobile telephone lines. In other words, wireless price per minute, which capped out in the early 90s with 58 cents per minute, 57 cents per minute, and dropped to 2000 to 21 cents, and now I think it's around, what, a dime or less? I don't know if anybody's seen the most recent figures for what they consider average price. Okay? I want to bring this back to market structure, to the HHI, to the relationship between market structure and prices. Because a lot of people argue that market structure is no longer important. And all I can tell you is that in the period of time, in the early 90s, the wireless industry was a duopoly. It had only two players. We got this huge decrease in price when the FCC went out and started selling more spectrum and adding players. So as the number of players go up, as the HHI goes down, as the market structure becomes more competitive, we got price reduction in the wireless industry. The next slide, you know, doesn't give you exactly the market structure in the wireless industry, but gives you a good idea that between these two time periods that I have here, how many markets were served by three or more and four or more competitors. It shows you how more and more people, more and more wireless providers were coming into the different markets. So as the wireless markets became more competitive, we had a new market structure moving from duopoly to four or five competitors. In other words, what I said was effective competition at the beginning is what is directly correlated. You can never say cost, you know, any causation, but there's a direct correlation between the increase in the number of players in the wireless industry and the drop in the wireless industry's rates. There could be other reasons. It's not, you know, I'm just telling you what's happened. This next, I think, is reason to pause. When we think about wireless as our poster child for competition. Because what happened in the wireless industry recently is that it's gone in reverse. The indexes are published, this is published FCC data. I took a weighted average of the national markets, and that's what the first row is, the Herfindahl index going up. In all your markets, it's going up. Okay. And here I'll go out on a limb as an economist. You're never supposed to forecast, but I'll forecast this. When I say in 5 years, 2,600, in other words, what the national weighted average will be, will probably be up to around 3,700. We're moving away from competition in the wireless industry. How did it happen? Two things, two major things. A lot of mergers that I think you're aware of. Sprint bought Nextel, AT&T, I don't know who all they own now. Right? If you watched Stephen Colbert, he had a nice little rearrangement of AT&T for you. The other thing is, and this what you might not be aware of, is that spectrum used to be limited from the point of view of how much any one individual carrier could own in any one market. Okay? So if there's, you know, this wide a spectrum and each person only could have this amount, there would be enough spectrum in that market to support five or seven players. But now there's no limit on how much any one player can own in the market. So if one player wants, if the whole spectrum is this wide in a market, and one player buys this amount of it, then there's only so much left over for other players. And in that way, you can use spectrum as a private company as a barrier to entry, because now you can buy up enough spectrum so that there can only be so many players in your market. I don't know how many places it's happened, but I know that you can do it. And if you can do it, and I'm a profit-maximizing company, I'm going to try to do it. Because there's no constraints on me. The other thing in this market, one of the reasons why I predict this is going to happen, is that, as you know, the new AT&T, which now has combined everything, has offered a new service package they call Unity, which provides significant benefits for individuals who use both AT&T as their wireless and wireline company. Now this, on its face of it, is a very, you know, strategic and good thing to do if you're a competitor. If AT&T had said, you know, in the Verizon homeland, you know, Virginia through Maine, that northeastern place, where my CLEC company is stagnant and retreating, I offer this service, this Unity service in that area to reinvigorate my CLEC business. That's a very pro-competitive act. Or if they did it in the Quest service territories, it's a very pro-competitive act. But if you're a dominant company with 70% of the wireline and 40% of the wireless air market, and you do the same thing, it's a predatory act. It's an act that will enhance your dominance, it is not a competitive act. Now, given the current set of judges and given the current ideas at the Department of Justice and the FTC, nobody's ever going to bring it. Nobody's ever going to trouble them about this. But I would think that if you had an aggressive antitrust, you would say, you can't sell this in your home territory. You can only sell it in the Verizon territories and in the Quest territories. But that's never going to happen. That's my pipe dream, that somebody might enforce the antitrust laws. They're not going to be enforced, and that's one of the reasons why I think that in another 5 years, the Herfindahl indexes in the wireless industries will go over 3,700, and we'll get fewer and fewer competition in that industry. Then I come back to returns of your favorite three companies here in Florida. You know, if there's really competition, can you sustain a 22% return? Now, I look at the ones that I've set in gray, and not the state returns, which you see right next to them, that are much lower, even though for Bell South, 16% is pretty good anyhow, because since the year 2000, there's been what's known as a separations freeze, and that's distorted these numbers, whether or not they're state or federal. I'm running out of time, Mark. Is that what you're trying to say? Okay. Hey, not much longer. Okay. So we got that one. Let's go to the next one. Verizon. Here's the rate increases people want to have. These have been what's asked for. These are all greater than 5% increases. So these all are admissions of the company that they can do what the Justice Department merger conditions say shows that you've got market power. If you can raise your rates like this, you got market power. And they all say they don't, but they all ask for rate increases. I think that's a little inconsistent. I mean, the next one is about service quality. Most people say that this is a text that's similar that you'll find in other places. Competition will breed competition to enhance service quality. You shouldn't have to worry about service quality if we have competition. Well, let me just give you a quick example of where that might have not a race to enhance service quality, but a race to reduce service quality. And if there's anybody from Verizon in the room, please write down that Bob Loeb has bought the Fios Triple Play, that I don't really hate Verizon that much. I do buy their services. Okay? But the first thing they did was that they came out and they cut my copper drop. What does that do? That means I no longer have central office power. That means that when my electricity goes out, my telephone goes out. Now, they gave me a six-hour battery. Well, a thunderstorm came through, and I was out of electricity for 3 days. That six-hour battery doesn't last for 3 days. So service quality, especially here where you've got hurricanes, you might start wondering, what are we going to do about here? Central power through the copper drop gives you a lot more reliability than you've got with the Fios system. And then finally, in my summary, we know that the traditional carriers, the ILECs, are facing more competition, especially in the triple play market. Okay? Especially from the cable companies coming in and offering all three things. If I remember correctly, here in Florida, you gave them accelerated depreciation a while back in the late 90s. And the gift of accelerated depreciation was for the telephone industry to upgrade and bring fiber to the customers. So we gave them the resources. The regulatory agencies gave them the resources to do the job so that they could compete with the cable industry. And if they can't compete, it's their fault. Wireless are taking an increasing share of the market. We know that. Everybody knows that. However, what has, and here again, it's a problem that the large companies own wireless and wireline, and they have to make a decision. Which end of the business do they favor? What if the wireline had come in and said, let's increase our local calling area? I don't know about Florida, but in the D.C. area where I've lived, the local calling area has been locked since like the early 50s. Nobody's increased the local calling area. But what has happened in the D.C. area is now we have outer suburbs that are outside. You know, 20% of the population lives outside the local calling area. Well, if you've got a wireless phone, you don't care how big the local calling area is. But if you've got a wireline phone, the local calling area is an important impact on your decisions. So if Verizon, which serves the Washington, D.C. area, really wanted to support its wireline company, it would have increased the local calling area to the size of the community of interest. But it didn't. And therefore, many people are going to wireless simply because they move to the outer suburbs and have to make a toll call to talk to their friends. So if you want to respond, you have another way to respond. And that's the last thing, is that all of these things have nothing to do with basic local service. Those people who are still buying basic local service, most of them don't have modems or DSL. Those are the people without the option. Those are the people that are, for the most part, just buying the local product. And they still need some help from regulators to control that one rate. That's it.